everyone, I'm Greg Baer, co-host of the Remaking Tomorrow podcast.
And I'm Ryan Rudzeski. And what you're about to hear is a rebroadcast of our appearance on another podcast called The World We Want. This is a podcast produced by the North American Association of Environmental Educators, in which we talk about what can we learn from Mr. Rogers about stewarding the natural environment. Enjoy.
Today's episode was recorded in person at NAAEE's 53rd annual conference in early November 2024.
Welcome to The World We Want, the NAAEE podcast. Hi, I'm your host, Jerry Ellis. So what is a world you want? For me, I want a world where we approach each other and our planet with curiosity and courage, to step into the unknown while having the strength that enables us to be vulnerable on that journey. And that's what's so remarkable about us humans. It's our willingness to optimistically take on the challenges of a complex world.
He didn't avoid talking about racism. He didn't avoid talking about war. He didn't avoid talking about divorce. He knew that kids, even young kids, have big, complicated feelings, and they bring their big, complicated selves to every scenario. And so he wouldn't have avoided the subject matter.
He was Fred Rogers, beloved host of the groundbreaking U.S. television series, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, where children learn the power of kindness, curiosity, and compassion. On this episode, our guests are two men who have spent decades learning about, and maybe more significantly, from Mr. Rogers. Children's advocate Greg Baer and award-winning reporter Ryan Rudzeski are authors of When You Wander, You're Learning, Mr. Rogers' Enduring Lessons for Raising Creative, Curious, Caring Kids. Their book reveals the science behind the iconic television program and the skills and mindset that scientists now consider essential, what Fred Rogers called the tools for learning. Thanks for joining us on the World We Want podcast, where we talk to some of the great thinkers, creators, educators, and conservationists, as well as some of the newest voices driving change from around the world. Our conversations are about the world they want and how they are working to build the world we all want. And what do they share in common? Environmental education, one of the most powerful tools for creating a more just and sustainable world. It inspires, it enlightens, it influences attitudes, and most importantly, it drives us to become stewards of this planet. So join me as Greg and Ryan take us on a 5-decade journey, a legacy of learning, to discover how one man did what no one else had done, help children and many grown-ups explore our complex world with curiosity, creativity, and collaboration. And most importantly, kindness, to create a world we all want. But before I jump into my conversation with Greg and Ryan, if you're new to the podcast or to environmental education in general, you should know that the World We Want podcast is a production of the NAAEE, the North American Association for Environmental Education.
Ryan, Greg, welcome to The World We Want. It's great to have you both with us.
Thanks for having us. We're really excited to be here.
Yeah, what other podcast would we want to be on, right?
Well, you have your own podcast. I assume you want to be on that podcast.
Some days.
Tell me a little bit about why you're connected to Fred Rogers and why you're connected to early childhood learning.
You want to start, Greg?
Sure. Well, I'm connected to Fred because I'm from Pittsburgh, which is a reminder that Fred Rogers was born just an hour east of Pittsburgh and recorded the iconic television show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, right here at WQED Television, America's first public television station. And I suppose my Fred days started when I was a kid, right? I was there 6, 7, 8 years old, sitting in the den, oftentimes with my brother, sometimes with my mom, watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. It was a core part of my childhood. Fast forward decades, I moved back to Pittsburgh as a young professional, and I had occasion to meet Fred Rogers and then to get to know his wife, Joanne Rogers, quite well during the last 20 plus years of her life. And I work in the field of education, particularly in the field of education philanthropy, a space in which I've worked for 20 years now, supporting teachers and museum exhibit directors and librarians and all of those caring adults that support creative learning opportunities for kids in and out of school. And in the course of that work, my colleague here, Ryan, and I get a chance to read a lot to understand what's happening in learning. How can we make learning experiences better for kids? And it was about almost 10 years ago now that we had an aha moment, because here we are in Pittsburgh, a place that we think about Fred Rogers the way that we think about the Pittsburgh Steelers and French fries on our sandwiches, right? Like, Fred is just part of the water. And we have an emotional connection to him. But what we began to realize as we were reading literature about learning, coming from learning scientists right here in our own backyard at Carnegie Mellon University or the University of Pittsburgh or from places around the country, is that learning scientists, as they were talking about learning and what we need to do for kids, were writing papers that increasingly to us read like scripts from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
You're kidding.
And that was our light bulb, right? Like, we're like, was Fred... could we represent Fred as a learning scientist? Was he one? How did he prepare his work? How did he do what he did? And what are the connections we could draw between today's learning science and what Fred was doing more than half a century ago? And lo and behold, digging into the research, digging into the archives at St. Vincent College at the Fred Rogers Institute, talking with so many of his still living colleagues, we realized there's a story to tell about Fred that goes beyond that emotional connection, beyond that red sweater that all of us remember so well.
And yeah, I remember the first time I went to a learning science conference, and I think I expected something very different than what I experienced. I'm a former teacher, so I thought I was going to go in and hear lots of nuts and bolts sort of pedagogical stuff, lots of charts and graphs. And you know what these scientists were talking about is exactly what Greg just explained. They're asking questions like, how do we make sure kids feel safe? How do we make sure that they know somebody out there cares about them? How do we make sure that they feel, as Fred used to say, loved and capable of loving? And, you know, once we started hearing that, and especially as a former teacher, I looked at it and I thought, this was everything that was missing from my own classroom. We don't always think of Fred Rogers as an educator, someone who we can continue to learn from today. Now, of course, he is the nice guy as in the sweater that we all remember him as. But there's so much more that we can continue to learn from Fred and many of the people who he worked with, many of whom are still creating programming and children's media and working in education today. So he's got this incredible legacy, not only as a television creator and a television host, but as an educator. And he left us, as his wife Joanne wrote in the foreword to our book, the blueprints for what modern learning can and ought to look like.
I want to get into that book in a short bit. So then how did you two connect? Where did that link came that you end up sitting here talking to us?
It was actually in a hotel, not unlike this one, just actually around the block from where we're sitting. And we got to talking about writing and about our work and about Mr. Rogers, of all people. We started working together, that was probably in 2013, 2014, on all sorts of things. Like Greg said, we work in education philanthropy. So we were researching and writing about things like playgrounds, things like what might technology, responsible technology use look like in classrooms, that sort of thing. And we realized, you know, after a while, we'd build up this pretty substantial body of work, all of which could be tied back to the lessons that Fred Rogers left for us. And I remember Greg saying, we should write a book. And I thought, we're never going to do that.
Yeah, but let me go back to where it starts in many ways, because, you know, life connected us.
Yeah.
I found in Ryan someone whose words seemed to match my own words. And at the time, I was pressed at work, and I had been given the honor and invited to give a talk at West Virginia University as the commencement speaker for the School of Education.
I intentionally didn't tell this story, by the way.
And I turned to Ryan and said, I'd like to give a talk that somehow integrates great learning with John Denver's country roads and a Fred Rogers sensibility.
And I walked out of that meeting thinking, I'm never going to write again. Why did I go into this? I should have been an accountant. I don't even begin to understand how this is going to work. And, you know, we worked on that speech for a while and we pulled it off, and we realized in doing that, that I think we started to unravel many of the threads that later became When You Wonder, You're Learning, that sensibility of looking to Fred as somebody who left us the blueprints for learning and in many ways for life.
And it was a really good talk.
I think so. I didn't give it, but I watched it virtually and applauded.
Sometimes it's those talks that you come into and you're just like, I don't know if this is ever going to work. And but they often resonate with people in a way in which you never could have imagined.
And isn't that where sparks and innovation happens? It's in those complementary things that are familiar to us. And we just think, what happens? How might we put these things together?
Well, I mean, we always talk about those aha moments, right? You know, that motivate us all in life. And most of the time, yeah, it's, you might know something, you might be a little prepared, but it really comes at you out of the blue and catches you off.
I think, yeah, when you're taking a risk, and that talk and this idea was definitely taking a risk. And, you know, I think it makes you feel more alive to your work when you're not quite sure how it's going to land or if it's even going to work. But the more of those risks you take, the more you open yourself up to those aha moments. And those aha moments can become something really, really big and important.
And it was a little bit of a risk representing Fred Rogers as a scientist.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, here's an emotionally loved person, part of core memories, and representing them as what could have been perceived as a staid, you know, rural-bound scientist.
In the background of all this, as we're discussing and thinking about what this book might look like, was this incredible resurgence of Fred Rogers in our culture. So we had a biography come out. We had Max King's biography. We had Morgan Neville's amazing documentary. And then we had just found out Tom Hanks was going to play Mr. Rogers. And so we're talking about this with the backdrop of suddenly everyone's talking about Fred again. And I think there was an enormous sense of responsibility, and for me at least, anxiety. How do we possibly write a book that lives up to the legacy of somebody who so many people love and how people have so many strong feelings about? There's a story, I think it might have actually been in this hotel, of Tom Hanks going up the elevator, and then some random person gets on and sees he's standing in the elevator with Tom Hanks. And instead of being starstruck and saying, "Oh my gosh, Mr. Hanks, I'm a huge fan," the person said, "Hey, I know you're in town to play Mr. Rogers, and I want you to know that we take him really seriously in Pittsburgh, so you better not screw it up." So like, that's the kind of person Fred is to us. And so it was having the permission and the encouragement of Joanne Rogers that I think really got this off
ground. Yeah, that was one of the first two phone calls we made before we even pursued this idea.
The scientist part. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you take somebody who's so beloved and is, and came across as so gentle and caring. I guess where I'm going with that is, if you present him as a scientist and he thought about these things scientifically, was he manipulating people? Mm-hmm. Was that whole persona of the sweater and being gentle and nice, was that just a manipulation of all of us?
Yeah, I think one of the major fears at the beginning was, you know, are we going to spoil the magic, right? By deconstructing what Fred did and trying to reveal the methods. It's almost like a magician doesn't reveal his or her tricks, right? I think the effect, though, I was worried that if we reveal all this to an audience, people aren't going to see him as Fred, as this special person who he very much was. But I think for us, the effect was the opposite, because when you realize how much intention and research went into every moment of this television program, you can pick any scene from almost 900 episodes. And if you understand the learning science, you can say, oh, Fred's doing that because, you know, X, Y, Z reason. And then you realize that Fred did that for every scene for almost 900 episodes for more than 3 decades. And you realize the sheer amount of effort and intention and will that went into what he did. And in our eyes, I think it only made him more impressive that somebody with an amazing team, to be sure, was able to sustain that kind of effort for so long. Because, you know, as he used to say, he wanted to give the best he could, and he really, really did. He never winged it. In fact, there was a story when Fred was helping another team get a children's television program off the ground, and somebody said, you know, they were going back and forth on a really difficult scene, and someone said, yeah, it's for kids. Who cares? Let's just do it and go. And Fred said, absolutely not. Because it's for children, we have to get it right. And Fred got it right for decades. And he could only do that through turning to science and turning to experts and being absolutely intentional and deliberate about every decision, no matter how small it might have seemed.
How intuitive do you think it was in the beginning?
No, it wasn't intuitive at all. And in fact, it harkens back to your previous question, about which I've been over here puzzling, because we've never been asked that question, right? And as I think about your question, we've never gotten into the hole of science good, science bad, right? Mm-hmm. Because while we present Fred Rogers as a modern day learning scientist, we're still talking about Fred Rogers, who had a scientific-like preparation for his work. And Ryan used the verb deconstructed. So as we deconstruct, how did Fred do what he did? What we can do is tell a story about a young man who's preparing for his livelihood, something to which any of us can relate. And there he is studying at the University of Pittsburgh. He's studying at the Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. And he decides that he wants to use this technology that he knows is so attractive to kids, the technology of television. And he said, how do I make what's attractive good? And when he decided he wanted to essentially take that technology and minister with it, his teachers there said, well, Fred, you better learn something about child development theory and practice. And that's the part of the story that was so then illuminating for me and Ryan, and I think illuminating for all of us as adults, because we can picture Fred as the student who's then studying with folks at a place called Arsenal Family and Children's Center here in Pittsburgh.
Still operating,
right? And studying with the likes of co-founders Dr. Benjamin Spock and Margaret McFarland. And then having the opportunity to study with Eric Erickson and other child development practitioners and psychiatrists and psychologists and masters of their time, and absorbing all of that. And then years later, we see that science in the most seamless ways possible. Well, we don't notice it unless it's pointed out to us, because it is so seamless, the ways in which that science comes through, that harkens back to his time studying with Spock and Margaret McFarland and others. So in so many ways, Fred's work wasn't intuitive. It was very planful, very deliberate, very intentional.
We sometimes joke that he was almost too good at it. I mean, it's really... the science is so well blended with art and with stories and songs. And Fred wrote like 13 operas and 200 songs. And all of this, if you look at it closely and you understand the learning science he was using, you can again see what kinds of decisions he was making in every song, every opera, every piece of clothing he put on. And there were times where, you know, this could be incredibly frustrating, as you might imagine. You're trying to create a television program and everything has to be based in some sort of intention. There were times when Fred would stop in the middle of the shoot, which was extraordinarily expensive to do at the time. And he would just walk up the street from WQED, where they were filming, to the University of Pittsburgh, where his mentor, Dr. Margaret McFarland, was a psychiatrist and his, lifelong friend. And he would sit down with her and he'd say, we're struggling with, should we call this episode Little and Big or Big and Little? And they would talk about it. And then Fred would walk back down to the studio. They would reshoot once he knew he had the scientifically grounded answer. And then they would go on. It's just, it's kind of incredible how closely he was paying attention.
So that's what I'm fascinated by with Fred, is the storytelling piece of it, which you were mentioning, whether it's an opera or whatever it is, it's storytelling. If he was doing that show now, and it was about environmental education, that was the core, how would he approach that, do you think?
If your listeners could see our eyes, right? We step back because we would never want to step in and pretend to know what Fred would do here at this very moment. But what we can do is look at his work and notice that he didn't avoid hard subjects. Mm. He didn't avoid talking about racism. He didn't avoid talking about war. He didn't avoid talking about divorce. He knew that kids, even young kids, have big, complicated feelings, and they bring their big, complicated selves to every scenario. And so he wouldn't have avoided the subject matter. And I suppose at best we can look at discrete programs or an entire week that he did in, I believe it was in the early 90s, all around environmental education. So there are probably lessons to learn from what he actually did. But I think most importantly is he wouldn't have avoided it.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that I've been thinking about a lot recently, so for our listeners, we're recording this on Election Day. there are a lot of fraught political topics on the table right now, to put it mildly. Climate change is certainly one of them. And Fred had this way of communicating that was incredibly bridging. And he used to say that people don't, you know, you don't change people's minds by pointing a finger at them. People only change in relation to somebody who loves them. And you can see that love pervading everything that Fred did. And, you know, you could criticize that approach and say, well, you know, some people need to have a finger wagged in their face. And maybe that's true. But it also remains true that from everything we know about human psychology and motivation and how you might change people's mind, it always starts from a place of love. And far from being sort of wishy-washy or both sides-ish, I think that that's an incredibly brave way to approach things like climate change, to start with love, to refuse to judge someone. And if you want to bring them around to believing whatever it is that you believe, you have to come to them from a place of fellowship, from a place of respect, from a place of deep listening and loving speech. And we see that again and again in the neighborhood.
And to paraphrase Fred, anything that's mentionable is manageable. Mm-hmm.
Hi, everyone. I'm Carrie Albright from NAAEE. Thanks for tuning into The World We Want, the NAAEE podcast, and learning more about the educator, scientist, and friend that was Mr. Rogers. In just a minute, we'll hear more from Ryan and Greg on how Mr. Rogers' practices have since been adopted in classrooms, research, and households. The World We Want is a project of the North American Association for Environmental Education. We share the stories of changemakers and educators who are working to create a more just and sustainable future. Be a part of that change. Visit our website, naaee.org, to see what's happening across the country and the world through this environmental education network. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, please consider adding a rating, a review, or subscribing wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And if you know someone who might benefit from a little of Mr. Rogers' messaging too, please share this episode with them. And you can find NAAEE on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and YouTube. Now back to Jerry, Greg, and Ryan to hear more about how Mr. Rogers' legacy of magic and science lives on, nurturing the curiosity and care of children, adults, and educators alike.
What's interesting is we seem to divide the science from the human being. And that's what I'm hearing from you guys about Fred, is he combined those two. And I think about what Fred Rogers did on that show. And if you just took that show and he walked outside, the impact that would have on children.
One of our favorite days in researching When You Wonder, You're Learning was going to visit the Fred Rogers Archive in Latrobe, which is where Fred was born. They still house all of his papers there. So if you walk into this office, this archive, it's just sort of a bland office room, you know, fluorescent lighting and lots of boxes. But in those boxes are 50 years worth of correspondence to Fred, from kids, from their parents, from their teachers, from adults who just were thanking Fred for being a presence in their lives. And what's amazing is that Fred responded to every letter he got. So if your listeners, if you wrote a letter to Mr. Rogers, you can probably go find it in the Fred Rogers archive. And you can see in the margins of these letters, Fred making notes and thinking about how he's going to respond. And that was our first indication that the neighborhood, even though television is a one-way medium, Fred talking to us, he also made it a conversation. He was listening. He was out there walking on the land, metaphorically speaking. He knew what was on his listeners' minds, and you could draw a direct through line between what their concerns were, and they would share some heartbreaking concerns, as you can imagine, with Fred in these letters, with what he is then talking about and how he's talking about it in Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. He was very much a listener as much as he was a presence on the television screen.
Well, and among other things, when he thought about connecting with people, he always reminded himself and his viewers to start in a familiar place, right? So if we were instead at a conference with machinists who wanted to show us how things are built and made, right? I could imagine those machinists wanting to like pull out the parts and talk about the mechanical engineering and what's happening. And so one of the things that Mr. Rogers did when he was trying to connect his viewers to hard or complicated subjects is that he started in a familiar place. So imagine instead that we're at a conference not about environmental well-being, but a machinist conference. And these machinists want to like show us their Harry Potter-like, you know, contraptions and the mechanical engineering behind us, behind it all. And they want to take us to that place. Well, that's what Fred did in the very familiar and famous crayon episode, where, you know, we go off to the factory and see where the crayons are made. But Fred doesn't start with the loud noises and the gadgetry and all of those machines and the whirling labeling of crayons. He starts very simply with a box of crayons, pulling out a crayon. You can probably imagine that crayon right now. You can smell that crayon right now. You can imagine yourself drawing with that crayon. And that's what Fred does. He starts and he pulls out his easel and he just starts drawing. And it's a reminder to start at a place that's familiar, then to take us off to that place of mystery. And so I can imagine then the folks at this conference involved in this association. Yes, we want to get to the hard topics. We want to wrestle with what it is that we can do. And it's a reminder to walk the ground and start where people are. Start with the food that they love. Start with the celebrations that they enjoy. Start with the things in their own backyard. Take them from that place that's familiar and comfortable off to then the place of mystery that's complex and filled with hard questions.
And that's why I was smiling earlier when you told us the story, Jerry, about talking to someone downstairs about climate change and how it's affecting hops and it's making our beer worse. And the person said, oh my gosh, I've never thought of it that way. So whether it's, you know, beer or a crayon, starting with that place that's familiar, something that we care about already, so that we can then ground ourselves and go on to the hard stuff. That's a very Fred method for sure.
Well, that it made me think of your book, When You Wander. And it's funny because it's W-O-N-D-E-R, When You Wander. And when I was doing the research, I thought it was W-A-N-D-E-R. And
well, when we wander, we wonder, yes.
But exactly. And just as you were describing in the story about the crayons, when we wander off to that place, but we have to wonder about it first. And how did you guys come to the title?
I wish we could take credit. So the title comes from a song that Fred used to sing called Did You Know? And the song says, did you know? Did you know when you wonder, you're learning? And we had a couple working titles for the book, all of which I thought were great. And when our publisher read the first chapter in which we talk about curiosity, we have the wonderful, great fortune to have permission to use some of the lyrics from Fred Rogers Productions. And they read that line, when you wonder, you're learning. And they said, this is what your whole book is about. I think this is your title. And, you know, they were right.
Now, I love the title. I love to steal the title. It's like I keep collecting for books that I've done in the past. I keep collecting phrases and stuff like that. You think, okay, that's a perfect chapter here.
Oh, well, there are hundreds of Fred songs for you to read and find probably perfect titles.
And to go back to what Greg's point earlier, that, you know, what Fred was doing in the program in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood in many ways mirrors what learning scientists are saying today. So just take that song, When You Wonder, You're Learning. Fred wrote that song in 1968. There are research papers today that say when we're curious, in other words, when we're wondering, something switches on in the brain. Your brain starts to take in information. So not only are you more likely to learn what it is you're wondering about, your brain starts to take in all sorts of other information too. Researchers say it's like a vortex that sucks in what you're curious about and also everything around it. So in a very real sense, Mr. Rogers was right. When you wonder, you are learning. One of the many ways that Fred was 40, 50 years ahead of his time when it comes to applying the learning sciences.
Well, that's why I a minute ago I was talking to you about environmental education, and I feel like sometimes we just have edged too far to the science side of it. We've sort of forgotten the wonder and the awe and the magic of it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you both about your learning, your perspectives. I know digital learning is important to you both. And like, how do we incorporate those things? How do you see those incorporated in education in general, especially environmental education, since we're here at this conference? How do we incorporate digital learning without making it the path rather than just a tool?
Well, that's the thing. I think you think about it just as a tool. whether it's a smartphone or AR or VR, it's nothing more than fire the fulcrum of the printing press, right? It is merely a tool that, when used well in developmentally appropriate ways, is something that might ignite a spark, might take you off to a place of mystery, might be a means by which to explore or discover something. And I think when we just are plain about that, that it's merely a tool, then we don't get caught up in the technological pace of it all.
Yeah, there's we talked to somebody in the book named Hedda Sherapin. Now, Hedda was a producer in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. She worked all the way back with Fred on the very first day of production in the late 1960s. Still working in education today, still here in Pittsburgh, still an incredible educator in her own right. And, you know, we were asking her for examples of Fred-like things that educators are doing out there in the world. And she gave us this. Do you want to talk about the Ask It Basket?
Sure.
We'll come back to digital tools, but it's important to understand what this Ask It Basket is.
So Hedda shares, so we're exploring the concepts of curiosity and some of the elements that go into it. And Hedda shares with us the story of visiting a classroom herself. And she has gone off to see a master teacher do her thing, right? So she goes to this building, goes into the classroom and walks in and sees a fairly large wicker basket taking up precious real estate. I say precious because there's so many things happening in any classroom. We can all imagine it right now. And she's wondering, why is this empty wicker basket taking up space? But she's there to watch a great teacher. So she goes to the back of the classroom and you know what? She sees exactly what she's gone to see. This teacher is incredible. She's obviously prepared. The kids are asking all sorts of questions. They're engaged. And one of the things that Hedda begins to notice is that the kids themselves are asking lots of questions. Now, sometimes those questions are right on point because it's designed as part of the instructional plan for that day. And so it's pedagogically important to respond to each student's question as it's asked. And Hedda begins to notice, too, that some of these questions are coming right out from over the left field wall, like things that were on the kids' minds. Maybe they dreamed about it. Maybe it was in their morning conversation, right? It had nothing to do with anything. And it's a reminder that each of us, whether a kid or an adult, bring our full complicated selves to every situation, to a podcast, to a book, to a dinner, whatever it might be. The great thing about this teacher is that she acknowledges the question that's been asked, even if it has come out from over the left field wall. She's noticed it, physically writes it down, and then walks over to the Ask It Basket, and which is what that wicker basket is called, puts it in and says, later together, we're going to wonder about the answer or answers to your questions. Now think about all of the magical things that are happening in that moment. One, that student knows that she's safe in that space, that I have permission to ask the things that are on my mind for whatever reason that they might be on my mind, and that I've got a caring adult here nearby me who's going to help me answer the things that are driving me on this particular day. That's a special thing. That's an atmosphere that a great learner, a great educator creates.
So fast forward to today, we have scientists at Carnegie Mellon University and the Pennsylvania Association for the Education of Young Children working on a digital tool to create a sort of digital Ask It Basket. And they come up with an app called Message From Me. And this is an app installed on iPads, digital cameras that are then placed in early learning settings. So kids throughout the day can take pictures of things that they're wondering about. Maybe it's a fish in the aquarium. Maybe it's a classmate. Maybe it's a drawing. They can take pictures of the things that make them curious, and they can record a voice message to go with that picture. That picture, that voice message then gets sent to that child's caregiver. So when mom or dad or grandma or grandpa picks her up at the end of the day, they don't have to just ask, you know, like, hey, what'd you do at school today? Because we all know where that question tends to land. That's what I used to say. And instead, they can say, hey, I noticed you were wondering about the blue fish. What do you wonder about the blue fish? How do you think it lives underwater? What else might we find underwater? It's a very Fred-like yet digital way of reminding kids that their questions are okay, that they have a caring adult who's going to encourage that sense of curiosity, and that even if those questions are coming out from over the left field wall, someone is out there paying attention to it and encouraging it and going out into the world with them to try to answer it.
So to go back to your question then, how do we think about digital devices and technology that's now available to us? Well, I think we think about it the way that Fred thought about that newfangled technology of television. He noticed that it was attractive to kids. and then said, well, this is attractive. It can be either used for good or ill. How do I make what's inevitably attractive good? Mm-hmm. Which is what I think any roboticist, technologist, entrepreneur, teacher is doing with all sorts of modern devices.
And, you know, Fred used to say that the best, most useful time for a television is after it's been turned off. When kids then have time to talk about what they've seen with a trusted adult, to talk about what they wonder. And when you think about effective digital tools today, I think the same thing applies. Digital tools can get us interested in the world. They can help take us out into the world virtually, but the best time, the best uses for them are after they've been turned off. When we go back to that relationship that we saw so clearly in Fred Rogers' Neighborhood, that we felt so clearly. When we turn those things off and we can then talk to the people around us about what they made us wonder or what we saw together, that's where the value of digital tools really lies.
Do both or either of you have children?
We both have two.
I'm a girl dad.
My youngest was born 9 weeks ago. So, yeah.
Middle schoolers. Big differences.
Reference points. How do you think about these kids and your interaction with raising them differently than you think you would have thought 20 years ago?
There's an incredible hazard to writing a book like this. I think it's given me more pause, maybe introduced more patience into my life, recognizing that I've got to step back and understand, why is my daughter bringing her full complicated self at this moment into this scenario, right? There's a real mindfulness that I think Fred's teachings have left with me. I think my wife and I are also much better about seeing the broader landscape as a place where the kids learn, right? Of course, they're going to learn at school. Ideally, they're going to learn at home. And how do we think of our city? How do we think of our region as something akin to Mr. Rogers' real life neighborhood? And how do we connect what's happening at school with a museum visit to an after-school program, a summer camp? I think we've been much more deliberate and intentional about thinking about the neighborhood and then also how we expose the kids to that neighborhood and allow them to sample all sorts of experiences so that they might find unexpected sparks or joys in things that we might not otherwise have introduced them to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with all of that. And I would just add that, you know, when we first called Joanne Rogers to ask her about this, to first of all, does this even sound right to you? And is it okay if we write it? And the answer was a resounding yes to both of those. But she said, you know, one thing you don't want to do is portray Fred as a saint, because if you do that, then what he did becomes unattainable, right? And there was nothing magic about Fred. It came down to science. It came down to his deliberate intention. It came down to his unwillingness to give anything less than his best to the kids who were looking up to him. And I think one of the greatest gifts of this whole multi-year journey has been to get to know the people who worked so closely with Fred and get to know the people who made this program that means so much to both of us and means so much to our kids as well. I mentioned Hedda Sherapin a few moments ago, the educator who told us about the Ask It Basket. Just a few days ago, she was at my house. She had knit my baby girl a new sweater and a knit hat. And she brought over Daniel Tiger figurines for my older son. And these are people who, in a very real sense, took care of me when I was a kid. And now they are helping to take care of my children. And it's a reminder that they are real people, just like Fred was a real person. And that is incredibly liberating, because it means that all of us can do this because we're all real people too. But it also adds an enormous sense of responsibility, because we know Fred and his colleagues were only able to do what they did because they were uncompromising. And it's a reminder that I need to be uncompromising as well when it comes to giving my kids and hopefully my neighbor's kids and Pittsburgh's kids the absolute best.
But isn't that the hard part?
It's the hardest part.
Right? Because we remind ourselves, and as Joanne instructed us, Fred was not a saint. He got mad. He got angry. He was just like you and me. And yet we know how deliberate and intentional he was, how uncompromising he was. And that's maybe the biggest challenge. Do I give enough time, space, yeah, thoughtfulness? Do I slow down enough myself to be deliberate and intentional? Mm-hmm. And most days the answer to that is no.
Yeah, my son's on this new kick where he digs the dirt out of our house plants and dumps it on the floor. And I'm working on becoming more patient. But, you know, I know he's exploring. And what is he wondering about? What's under that dirt?
This is environmental education at its core. This is bringing it home right there. I do want to ask you one last question, because this is called The World We Want. And I think, Greg, it was on your website that I read this. And this is actually something that Fred apparently said. Right. Often when you're at the end of something, you're at the beginning of something. And that's exactly where we find ourselves now. What something else will look like is largely up to us. And I thought that was so beautiful, because it is what we designed this podcast to be. What is the world we want? And that's largely up to us. So I love to ask both of you that question. What is the world you want out of this that maybe is the world we all want?
It is such a great question, and so much so that I want to hear first from Ryan.
He's stalling. He's trying to think of an answer. it is. I love the question. And it makes me think of, you know, when we were researching this book, George Floyd had just been murdered. COVID was in full swing. There were protests outside our window. You know, it was a hard time for everybody. And it felt at first, I was like, well, you know, is it even responsible to spend this time watching a children's television program, right? Is it escapism to just spend all day watching Mr. Rogers? And what really shocked us is that, you know, the neighborhood, we remember it as this sort of beautiful, sunny place, and it often wasn't. Fred went to some really dark places. He grappled with really difficult issues, as Greg mentioned earlier. And so we were trying to think, like, why do we remember the neighborhood so fondly when Fred really portrayed it, you know, the world as it was rather than the world as he wanted it to be? And it makes me think of a quote from Mary Rawls, who was an actress on, Mary Rawson, I'm sorry, who was an actress on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And she said that in the neighborhood, violence and war and hatred and intolerance are not painted out of the picture, but neither are they allowed to destroy the canvas. So I think what I want is a world where adults are unwilling to let those things, are unwilling to let the world as it is destroy the canvas of what could be. And that's why I'm so happy to be here with all of you. And I'm so grateful for what you and your listeners are doing out in the world, because you're out there defending the canvas. And we need as many people out there willing to do that as we can get.
Well, thinking of that canvas, honestly, for about 25 years, I've been writing and rewriting an article that stays on my desk. And it's an article about love, which on one hand can be seen as like something soft, something pathetic, right? Like, why are we talking about love and talking about it in a public space? But the world I want is a place where we ask hard questions, where we are sober about that verb love, and genuinely ask ourselves out loud, in public, with and in front of others, how much do we love? How much do we love this planet? How much do we love our kids? How much do we love our neighbors? To me, there's nothing soft or otherwise about that. It's the hardest question facing us as human beings. And I would love a world in which very publicly, very loudly, we talk about what it means to love.
Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for your great questions. We've had a great time. I mean, we are sometimes the luckiest two people in Pittsburgh, maybe in the world, because we get to just go around talking about Mr. Rogers. But, you know, we only get to do that because people care and people want to hear and continue to learn from him. So thank you for your thoughtful questions. And I hope this was worthwhile for you as well.
I want to thank Greg and Ryan for taking us on a journey into Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and discovering the toolbox of learning and how approaching a complex world with curiosity, creativity, and collaboration, but maybe most importantly, kindness, can help us build the world we all want. To learn more about the education work of Greg Baer and Ryan Rudzowski, as well as more about the World We Want podcast, visit our website at naaee.org naaee.org/podcast. That's naaee.org/podcast. I'm Jerry Ellis. For everyone at the World We Want podcast, join us next time to hear how together it's possible to create the world we want. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing the World We Want, the NAAEE podcast.